Welcome, everyone, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. With me is my co-host, Mr. Barry Rose. Barry, how's it going?
Jeff, it is going great, man. It is. It's a beautiful day here in the suburbs of Philadelphia. I'm feeling good. I have my trusty wonder pup, Ozzy, next to me, and I am ready to rock and roll because we have a hell of a show today, don't we?
Well, I'd like to think so. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on live. On today's show, we are going to be discussing four, count them, four of my top 100 of the 80s. Barry asked me once, he says, what are we going to do when we run out? I don't know if we're ever going to run out of this damn thing. Three of the matches are in the top 100 itself. One of the matches in the top 20. And we're also going to be discussing, as suggested recently by one of our listeners, whose name I can't remember. Sorry, Barry, maybe you can help me. Top five favorite Robert De Niro films. Barry, I know you got your list ready on that.
I'm ready to go with that, too. And unfortunately, I don't remember who suggested that. One of the things that I truly love about not just what we're doing right now, but the interaction in our Facebook group is so much fun. And, you know, it's so cool when you get this group of people, male, female, otherwise, that not only love wrestling, but love all the weird shit that we talk about, whether it's obscure movies or music or even something more as mainstream as, say, Robert De Niro. So it's a lot of fun. Unfortunately, Jeff, my memory sucks sometimes, and I have no idea who suggested this.
Well, I'm sure they'll pop up in the group and say, hey, idiot, it was me. But I digress. So the De Niro films, I will give a little spoiler here. Shockingly, Barry and I, now let's remember, this isn't what we think are the best Robert De Niro films. This is our favorite, our personal favorites. Shockingly, Barry, we both realized Raging Bull, regarded by many as his greatest movie ever, not in our top five, either one of us. How did that happen?
How much shit are we going to take on Facebook this week for not putting in our top five? And the truth is, it came down. Look, I looked at it and I said, Raging Bull or The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle? And
that's a tough call.
A tough call. You understand. It's a tough call.
Yeah, you know, you got Rocky and Bullwinkle. That's a tough call. However, good news, our beloved producer, the great Brian Last, has a particular film that he had in mind and said, by God, it better be in there. Good news, it's in there. No spoilers. We'll talk about it later. So first of all, we're going to go to our four matches. We're going to start off with on February 16th, 1989, Saturday night's main event, Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson versus the Rockers. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match recently. Tell me what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so, you know, interesting, too. So you're really taking two of the best tag teams of that era, and you're putting them in a match, aired on Saturday night's main event. It was two out of three falls. So I wrote some notes on this, and then I'm going to give you my personal opinion when it's all done. But the interview with Mean Gene in the beginning is it's unintentionally hilarious because Heenan's there. There's dissension in the ranks. I want to say, was this the last match that the Brainbusters had in the WWF? Do you know?
I don't know if it was the last match. I think it might have been the start of them starting to head out of town because, as I recall, Arn didn't show back up to the NWA till, I want to say, like fall. So I think they made it, you know, kind of played out the string for a few more months, but without Heenan in their corner.
Yeah, without Heenan. And then they also make the reference to the fact of the match where Heenan took Tully Blanchard's place just a couple of weeks earlier. And they put that on that there's dissension in the ranks and Tully didn't show up or whatever. But that was the night that I want to say that Tully failed the drug test and wasn't allowed to wrestle or something had happened at that point. So this might have been one of the last matches that they had. And Heenan's there. Pardon me. And they're obviously going through a lot of issues at this time, and they're getting ready to split, which you can clearly see. They're laying it out for you. And at the end of the interview, Mean Gene calls it a very unusual pep talk, which I just thought was unintentionally hilarious. But the first half of the match is really just a backdrop for the problems between Heenan and the Brainbusters. And then after the Brainbusters drop the first fall, Heenan just leaves. He goes to the back. He gets an interview with Jesse the Body Ventura, and he fires the Brainbusters. you know, as I'm watching this too, you know, a couple of things immediately come to mind for me. One, you had the Brainbusters. You know, that's great to give them a name, and I get that aspect of it because WWE was huge in marketing. But at the same time, you had really what was one of the best tag teams in the U.S., and it was kind of a wasted opportunity. And I know that they held the titles, but so much more could have been done with them. And watching Marty Jannetty in this match was a real highlight because Marty's obviously become this punchline now, whether it's wanting to have sex with somebody he thought was his daughter or, you know, drug and alcohol issues and just these outrageous, moronic comments that he makes on Facebook. And he really is a punchline. But at the same time, in his heyday, Marty was a really, really good worker. And it's kind of sad to see that. I thought this was a good match. I thought the work rate was good. It was definitely rushed. You know, you've got a three-fall match that maybe is going less than 15 minutes. That's super rushed to me. Just seemed like another match to me. And I honestly don't see where this particular match holds up and should be in a top 100. I don't know. It's not there for me.
Well, I have to say, after I watched this match, this was probably in the arenas a great program when they had time to work out a proper match. This match absolutely doesn't belong. And this match absolutely doesn't belong almost to a level of, since our standard for not belonging is Akira Maeda versus Donna Kaya Nielsen, this is on that
yes.
level. And yeah. I watched this match and I was like, what the hell did I see in this match 30 years ago? It was, first of all, it was extremely rushed. It makes you realize, as great as Heenan was, this combination of putting Heenan with Anderson and Blanchard, two guys that could talk on their own, everybody in the promotion, for God's sake, did not need a manager. And these two guys didn't need a manager because whether, you know, I never was really, I think I've said it, I was never a huge Tully Blanchard fan. Huge Arn Anderson fan. And even if you put tape over Tully's mouth, Arn Anderson could have carried the vocal skills for this team easily. They didn't need Bobby Heenan except as their comedic foil. So yeah, the whole match basically is a backdrop, as you said, for the split of Heenan from Tully and Arn, which is a shame because there's some nice stuff going on in the match, but nothing that elevates it to a top 100 of the decade. First fall, for God's sakes, goes literally 2 minutes. The second fall is 5 minutes in. So like you said, three falls within a 15-minute period, even by WWF standards, were pretty rushed at the time. I have to say, the outfits the Rocker's wearing, that's just like right out of central casting for the late 80s into the early 90s. Shawn Michaels' hair, it looked like someone just took like a fern and put it on top of his head because his hair is just kind of going all different ways. They were a great, both teams were super teams, you know. I mean, the Rockers had a history of being generally considered assholes in pretty much every territory they worked. But inside the ring, they were absolutely a great team, you know, much like the British Bulldogs. Pretty much everywhere they worked, everyone thought of them as assholes, but they were a tremendous team. And the Rockers were the WWE's version of either the Rock and Roll Express, the Fantastics, whoever you want, the young rock and roll tag team. They certainly got over. They got over to the point where Shawn Michaels was made into a singles. He's a tremendous talent. But this match definitely does not belong in the top 100. Now, did they have a match out there that belonged in the top 100? Very much, you know, could be, but not this one. This one, in retrospect, is just it's more about the angle than the match itself, which is kind of a shame because I would have loved to have seen these guys get 30 minutes to go out and tell a story. You know, you could have done the split early in the match, you know, since they were going to do it, you know, anyway. But, they took away from the tag match by doing an interview with Heenan backstage after the split. And instead of being able to watch the match in the ring, we got it in. There's nothing wrong with a Heenan interview. He's a great interview. But, you know, if you're trying to watch the match between four super performers at the time, it really took away from it. So, yeah, this match definitely does not belong on my top 100. So next, we are going to go to Japan. We're going to stay in 1989. This one, we're going July 13th. We are going Jushin Thunder Liger versus Naoki Sano. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match via a special gift from your co-host and the New Japan World Code. Why don't you tell us what you thought of this match?
Yeah, and it's a great match, too. And I'm going to do a little backstory on this one. So around it's either 1990, maybe 91. I was friendly with Alex Marvez, and Alex was working at the Miami Herald at this time. And I was so taken with Liger. And I think we should also say Liger was the darling of wrestling fans back in the late 80s and early 90s, because he was doing stuff that we really weren't used to seeing. Just an incredible worker on every different level. You know, his outfit, his mask, the guy was a beast. And Alex and I had developed this friendship, and Alex had a box of wrestling tapes, and it was like 100 tapes, and they were all from Japan. And I borrowed them from Alex and certainly kept them for about a year, if I recall correctly. And I apologize, Alex. I still procrastinate to this day. But one of the things that I did when I was going through all of his tapes is I pulled off every Jushin Liger match, and I made compilation VHS tapes, which I still have to this day, and I've actually transferred them to DVD. And that was really the idea of wanting to get these tapes, was that I wanted to get as much as I could of Liger and kind of consolidate and put them all together and just watch his matches. And he had several matches with Naoki Sano during this time period. I know there was at least one more match, which took place a month or two later, if I recall correctly. But they were really matched up well. And Sano, to me, he wasn't at the level of Liger as far as, you know, flashing. The truth was, this is the Liger show. I mean, when you watch this match against Sano, and Sano gets some offense in this match, and it's primarily the last 4 or 5 minutes, but this is Liger. And, you know, and you watch it, and you just go, oh, my God. And Sano's interesting because, you know, he's a smaller guy. He's jacked up. I mean, you know, the guy's trapezius muscles, you know, are just popping out. So from a guy that, you know, is maybe 5'5 or 5'6 max, you know, he's got all this muscle on him. And this, when you see it, you understand why Liger was the darling of the sheet readers and the smart fans back in the late 80s and 90s. He did this one thing, which I see because I still follow wrestling to this day. And he does this leg lock into a bridge, which I think is the finisher that Austin Aries uses. And then Liger did this elbow drop off the top rope, and it's effortless. It's like he's literally just floating through air when he lands. Just, it's a thing of beauty. He does this drop kick into the ring corner, immediately followed by a Pele kick, and that makes it 2 weeks in a row that I've referenced the Pele kick, and then does a suplex from in the ring to outside of the ring on the ring floor. Liger literally threw everything he had at Sano, and it was like a human highlight reel. And at one point, Sano, it looks to me like he's almost ready just to pass out. But yeah, Liger gives him an Irish whip into the ring ropes, and Sano just basically collapses. And Liger then goes into a rest hold. My assumption is he really was out of it when you see it. You know, there's a double count out, which is really what the finish was. But Sano gives Liger this belly-to-back suplex off the top rope, and neither man can get up. And it really is. And I don't know if this match 15 or 20 minutes. You might remember better than I do with that. But they just go for it. This is just guns blazing. It's a highlight. You know, I think if people were going to critique this now, they call it a spot fest. But at the same time, this is one of the most energetic matches. And considering this is 29 years old, I don't think we were seeing anything else like this during this era. Do you?
No, you know, and here's the interesting thing. You know, I had Naoki Sano as a guy that kind of got lost in the shuffle there, because he was really pushed as Liger's first big opponent when they first created, you know, Liger, of course, is Keiichi Yamada. And when they gave him the character of Jushin Liger, the first real feud or program that he had was with Naoki Sano. And what happened was soon after, I want to say 6 months to a year after this match happened, and later in our series of podcasts down the road, there is another match that these two have that is in my top 100. I want to say from September. That is also a top 100 match of the decade. Now, I know that circling around about 6 months later, I want to say in February or March of 1990, they had, I want to say, the Observer's Match of the Year for 1990. So this was a program that went on for a good 6 months to a year, and it was off the charts. But Naoki Sano left New Japan to go to the promotion called SWS that basically was started by Jinichiro Tenryu, who had left All Japan. And after Sano left, he never really reemerged as a star. He went and did some MMA stuff. He worked for SWS for a while. I want to say he came back. I don't know if he came back to New Japan or All Japan, but he just never achieved the heights that he had here at this point in the match. And so he was Liger's first big opponent in the guise of the character of Liger. So I watched this match and I enjoyed it so much. And this match, as Barry said, is off the charts good. So I reached out to the Melts and I said, so in the context of things, because I have to say the word context in every single episode, Barry, I said, where would you put Sano in Liger's list of opponents? Is he top three, top five, top 10? And Dave said, I would say he's probably top 10, but not top three. And, you know, Dave mentioned that he thought that Liger's greatest opponent ever was Chris Benoit, who, of course, is not mentioned by anyone in the WWE anymore for obvious reasons. But that just shows you how amazing Liger's career is, that a guy like Sano, and folks, if you watch this match, consider what Dave said. He was a top 10 opponent of Liger. And these matches are off the charts good, but Liger is so great, this guy isn't even in his top five. He's maybe top 10, Dave said. So the thing, perspective, Sano to me kind of looks a little bit like Toshiaki Kawada, who we'll be getting to later in this show. The referee, we talk about referees. This referee is Petey, who is sort of the second referee for New Japan during this time period after Masao Hattori. Petey spoke English, obviously, because Petey was the guy when I went to a spot show in 1987 that Dick Murdoch famously said, Petey, it's time for the go home. So Petey was the guy that translated all the stuff for the English speaking guys. They do a test of strength into an inside cradle, which was just a super move. He does Liger does a surfboard into a crucifix. He gives him a flying elbow that, dare I say, is Randy Savage-esque. Just a tremendous move. Barry talked about the sequence. The match goes to a double countout about 16 minutes into it. So, a tremendous match. Definitely, definitely belongs in my top 100. Barry, let me do a little poke into the bear here. Sure. Tell me what you think Jushin Thunder Liger / a.k.a. Keiichi Yamada, what is his legacy? I mean, is this guy, because you think about how many great opponents this guy had, how many great wrestlers he faced, the great wrestling matches he had, the way that he brought in different wrestling styles from Mexico, from the United States, from Canada, and Japanese opponents also to the matches that he had in New Japan and all over the world. What is his legacy? Is he a top 10 wrestler ever? Because I think he certainly should be considered because he has an amazing, amazing body of work.
Yeah, he absolutely is too. And you said it, he has this amazing body of work, and Liger still is a compelling wrestler to watch to this day. He's not at the same level he was 30 years ago, and I mean, how could he be? At the same time, he's still compelling to watch. So yeah, I'd agree. In my opinion, his legacy, there are two people that really revolutionized and redefined the junior heavyweight categories. And the first would be obviously the original Tiger Mask. Sayama, you know, the stuff he did was just absolutely off the charts. But the second coming of that, in my opinion, was Liger. Liger was the reason you were watching New Japan wrestling in the late 80s and early 90s. Where All Japan had, you know, a much rougher style with the King's Road style, this is, to me, Liger was the guy that you were, the only reason, and there were other guys, but honestly, Liger was the only reason I was watching New Japan in the late 80s and early 90s, because he was so interesting, just a great style, but between the mask and the outfit, just such a revolutionary style of wrestler. So I have a question for you. Who would you call, knowing what Dave Meltzer thought, who would you call Liger's greatest opponent ever?
Before I give you that opinion, I want to throw out some names for the listeners here. Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Jericho. These are all guys who really kind of made their bones in the New Japan rings. And it was the matches that these guys had. Eddie Guerrero versus a black, he took the guy as a Black Tiger in New Japan. But yep, these guys made their reputation in the rings against Liger. And it was Liger and then you know, these guys moved on to different, but I mean, the point is they got their first real break in the pro wrestling business, wrestling against Jushin Thunder Liger. So, you know, I don't know if I'd go with Benoit. I know a lot of people think, I'm going to mispronounce his first name, but his last name is Otani. Otani in the early 90s, a lot of people think where it was Liger's.
Shinjiro, right?
Yes, yes. Shinjiro Otani was his greatest opponent. And so, no, some of the matches he had against those three guys, he had great matches against Owen Hart before he took the mask when he was wrestling as Keiichi Yamada. And, you know, here's another thing to consider. This guy, as great as he is, think about what he had to overcome as a guy who was, as Barry said, maybe 5'5", 5'6". So he had a strike against him from the very get-go. So he didn't just have to be good. He had to be better than good just to get the guys that ran New Japan, whether we're talking about Shinma, Inoki, Sakaguchi, just to get those guys to accept him in the rings of New Japan, much less to push him as a huge star. Think about how good this guy had to be. He had to make, you know, he had to make himself greater than the sum of his parts, almost to say. So, yeah, Keiichi Yamada, amazing, amazing wrestler, still going on to this day. You know what he does that no one else does that I think is a really interesting wrestling technique in a pro wrestling ring is he doesn't punch. He doesn't use the bolo-like forearms. He uses those palm strikes. And yep. That's like his gimmick. He's the only guy in New Japan that uses it. I've never seen anyone else use that gimmick either. Have you?
No, you're 100% right, too. He does that, too. So, and I'm going to answer that. So I am going to agree with Meltzer. I do think the Pegasus Kid, which was Chris Benoit underneath the mask, was arguably my favorite series of matches. And they had four or five matches because I remember putting them and compiling them for this videotape I was making. But his body of work at that stage, and I want to say I made 2 to 3 videotapes, 2 hours each, and it's just all Liger. Like, that's how good he was. And all, you know, he couldn't have a bad match back in that day. And they put him in with a couple of stiffs. They put him in with this one guy who was a sumo guy. Do you remember that? Mm. Was it a yogi? He's still able, because he was so interesting, he's still able to get something out of it. But I would have to say Pegasus Kid, the Eddie Guerrero Black Tiger, as you mentioned, was fantastic, and even Owen Hart. So, yeah,
well, and here's
a tremendous wrestler.
And here's a guy that we've completely haven't mentioned yet, but he came over to America and WCW and wrestled Brian Pillman in some terrific matches. So Brian Pillman's another guy that he elevated Pillman by just carrying Pillman through these tremendous. I mean, not that Brian Pillman was a stiff. I mean, he was a really, really good wrestler, but he was turned into a great wrestler because he was in the ring with Jushin Thunder Liger, who was a great wrestler. So
yeah.
The next match we're going to talk about, we are going to go to, again, 3 matches from 1989. Who would have figured it? We're going to July 23rd, 1989, Baltimore, Maryland, The Bash. Barry, I was actually at this match, Ric Flair versus Terry Funk. You had a chance to watch it. Tell me what you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, if we're talking about the darling of sheet readers during this era, Flair and Terry Funk are probably right there with Liger as well. I would imagine that's like 1, 2, and 3. I'm not quite sure in what order, who goes where, but at the same time, so I'll give you my notes of this. Flair gives a very subdued interview with Soli prior to the match. I hate the double ring. You know, this was one.
Oh,
of those
my
double,
God.
I think it was.
Yeah, don't get me started on that.
You'd have to be, you know, so as a fan, so I went, you know, and this is, I'm going to bring up something current, but I went to a WWE show this past summer, and it was the Punjabi, I think it's the Punjabi cage match, what they call it, and sure. It's Randy Orton versus Jinder Mahal, and they built this structure. When you see it, it's the most impressive thing on the face of the earth. The problem is you can't see what takes place in the ring because all of these supposed bamboo poles are blocking any sort of view. So in my head, I'm thinking, so if you've got this two-ring battle royal, what are the people on the other side of the empty ring watching? Like, you're peering. It's terrible. What a horrible concept to even think of something like this. So in any case, getting back to this though, Funk is just shy of his 45th birthday when this match takes place, which is kind of mind blowing because he's arguably one of the best wrestlers in the country during this match. Gary Hart at ringside, commentators are saying that he's being very conspicuous by not getting involved in interfering. So I'm going to poke the bear on this one, Jeff. Gary Hart, his legacy in the state of Florida as far as getting Dusty Rhodes over and everything was fantastic. I just don't get him here. His interviews are okay, but I know that he didn't want to take bumps because he had some sort of either back or neck issue. But at the same time, you know, he doesn't sell anything. You could punch him and he just, like, you know, just stands there. So Gary Hart to me is kind of a wasted opportunity here. But of all the mistakes that NWA and WCW made during this era, this was great. I mean, we can talk about Ding Dongs and all this other shit that they did during the Jim Herd era. And I don't know who is responsible for this. And my feeling was it's probably Ole Anderson. But at the same time, this really was fantastic. Tommy Young, you watch Tommy Young and you say, okay, is he the greatest ref of all time? He certainly is. He did one thing that I don't like, and that he's pulling Terry Funk's hair to get him off of Flair. And I always felt when a ref puts his hands on a wrestler, there's something to that that just doesn't quite work for me. Jim Ross is doing commentary with Bob Caudle. Bob is great. Jim Ross is good. He does say a couple of things. He states one fact that Terry Funk won the NWA World title from Jack Briscoe with the spinning toe hold, which is not true. I was there in the first row that night, and that did not happen, Jim Ross. Kind of a surprise finish. Flair wins it with the reverse inside cradle. But in my opinion, this is where the action starts. Muda comes out. He attacks Flair and sprays him with the green mist. And there's a beatdown for a couple of minutes. And Sting then makes the save. And then this brawl takes place. And this brawl is top shelf stuff here when it comes to the brawl. Because this is a brawl. And they really did this right. And this is what I liked about it, is they separated them like four times. And they would get back together and start to brawl again. And the fans are losing their minds. And then this is also where the iconic interview with Flair, and it's a really short interview, it's maybe just a minute or so, but Flair's got the green mist on the face, the blonde white hair, and then it's been streaked with blood. And he does this interview, and he calls Sting over, and he really makes Sting. This is where, you know, pal, thank you. I haven't thanked anybody in 10 years, and I want to thank you. So I love this. I just, you know, the only thing, if I was going to criticize this match in any form, and this is minor, I wouldn't have had Terry Funk lose. You know, it's essentially a clean loss for Funk. It should have been a DQ, whatever. It just do something. But I wouldn't have had Terry Funk get pinned. What do you think about that?
So here's what I think, just based on your question. Number one, you're absolutely correct. They shouldn't have done the double rings. I know they had some. I can't remember. I was there, and I can't remember why they had the double rings there. Gary Hart added nothing to this match other than, you know, having Muto come out at the end. Gary Hart to me post, I want to say like 83, 84 ish, kind of lost a lot of steam. I was never a huge, huge fan. Like you said, he did some top notch work in Florida. I liked his stuff in Georgia with Kabuki, you know, against Dusty. That was fun stuff. Of course, the stuff against the Von Erichs in Texas, but he just brought nothing to the table on camera. I don't know whether or not he was doing a role behind the scenes. Just to correct you, Barry, I hate when that happens. Ole Anderson, Ole Anderson was not here at the time. So whatever clusterfuck the WCW was at this point, it had nothing to do with Ole and probably everything to do with Jim Herd. Recently on the Jim Cornette Experience, Jim Cornette took a very detailed look through, I know, the early part of 1989. I don't know if he went through the entire year, and pretty much laid everything on Herd's desk as being the guy that kind of completely fucked things up. Now, let me share my notes. The interview with Gordon and Flair, I loved it because it really came off like a professional. It wasn't a wrestling interview. It was a professional sports interview.
Yep.
Because Gordon asked him, you know, like, well, what happens if you injure your neck? And he said, Gordon, this is all I know. You know, he said, if I didn't consider the possibility that my neck could get injured, he says, I'd be a fool if I didn't consider that. Gordon asked him, you know, is your timing possibly off? And he said, well, you know, I didn't think of that either. Maybe my ego Got me back a little bit earlier than I should have. And I just thought the interview was so tremendous because it was like Flair was being honest. And, you know, this wasn't the, you know, woo. And, you know, I'm Space Mountain, baby. It was none of that. It was serious Ric Flair, which is such a nice change of pace from the, you know, the Space Mountain, you know, limousine riding guy. And I know everybody loves that, but, you know, it's nice to see Ric Flair talking like a normal human being and not a character sometimes. Gary, let's see. Gary Hart is Funk's big surprise. They listed the attendance in Baltimore as 14,000, which I always thought the cap in Baltimore was at the arena was like 10,000. So I don't know if they were fudging the numbers there. But I will tell you this. That crowd is probably one of the hottest crowds I've ever seen a WCW show have. I mean, these people were on fire. And compared to some of the other WCW pay-per-views that you'll see after this going into the Starrcade of 1990 and some of the shows after that, this crowd in Baltimore was white hot and they were on fire. Let's see what else I got here. Terry, absolutely, for 45 years old, you said he looked shredded for his age and just did a great job. He does a thing where he blocks a suplex that he's attempting to do on the floor. This is, we talk about how grudge matches that we hate nothing more than for two guys who have a real heated situation, a heated program or feud to lock up Collar and Elbow like they're doing a wrestling match. Flair goes out and gets Terry Funk, and they start this thing like a good old-fashioned brawl, and that's the way it should be done. And I really appreciated that they were doing it that way. Here again, Terry being Terry, we talked about Terry's influence on guys like Dick Murdoch and Dick Slater and other wrestlers like that. Here in the middle of this heated match, he does like this quick 10-second curly shuffle, and it just looks so out of place with him doing that. That was one of the few complaints I have about the match. Flair, by the way, one thing that Ric Flair can't do is he can't do a pile driver because his pile drivers on Terry looked horrible. Flair bled, but what was interesting was he bled, it looked like, from the very top of his forehead. This was not like, you know, above the eyebrow or anything like that. I love the spot where Flair's outside the ring and Terry comes out the ring and sort of drops his entire body across the back of Rick's neck because they're selling the, you know, the injured neck. Let's see here. What else I got? The green mist by Muda that you mentioned. He hits Flair. Flair's got the blood and the blonde hair. And the way that I described it, and I remember reading about it in the Observer, was that Flair looked like a Christmas tree because there he was all the they go to injure Flair and Doug Dillinger, the head of security, and I'll never forget the boys in Greensboro always referred to Doug Dillinger as the man who crippled Sting. But here, Doug Dillinger comes in to block them from trying to injure Flair with the pile driver on the chair, which is a great sequence because it really added to the realism of the thing. Here, this is not, you know, just a wrestler doing a run in to save him. This is a guy that's the head of the corporate security coming in to block an attempt to injure, you know, the world champion. So I thought that was very believable. Let's see. The post-match brawl. Good Lord. You know, the match, I think the match might have gone something like 20 minutes or so. The post-match brawl goes a good 10 minutes, and it's as good a WCW brawl outside the ring as you'll ever see because guys are there's a point where Funk is outside the ring, and he takes a chair and throws it into the ring, and I don't know if Rick wasn't expecting it, but it kind of hit Rick, and Rick jumps out of the ring and chases after Funk and really, you know, gets the brawl going again. You know, one of the things that we didn't talk about that I think is an interesting politically part of this match is that you had Funk and Muda basically as a team here. And I know going into, I believe, Halloween Havoc and some of the other things, Muda was also teaming with Funk. Muda was a New Japan guy and Funk was completely an All Japan guy. So I really wonder what the Japanese magazines had to say about that at this time, because that would have been kind of a big deal in Japan, I'm sure, at the time. So not only a great match, and you know, one thing I'll say about this is Muda, when he does the run and all the stuff that happens with Muda, it reminds me why Dave Meltzer at the time did not refer to him as the great Muda. He referred to him as the fucking great Muda, because that's how good Keiji Muto. And you know, here, Barry, speaking of Keiji Muto, we saw Keiji Muto in the, I want to say around what, 1986 in Florida, when he was wrestling as the white ninja, and which you could just see the guy oozing potential then. And do you remember seeing much of Muda in Florida then?
Oh yeah, absolutely too. He was great, but there was some. I mean, he was young in his career too. I don't even know what, but there was something that was missing that, you know, I don't know if it was some sort of charisma thing. And the truth was, by the time 3 years had passed, and I think the face paint was a great idea, but he really was something else. And, you know, even to this day, you know, his style of wrestling now is nowhere near what it was, but he's got this whole charisma thing going. It's kind of a subdued charisma, but he had some good matches. And he had a match with Kendall Windham, believe it or not, and this is at the stage, really, in my opinion, before Kendall really became a decent worker, and had a really decent match with Kendall one night. So Muta was, he really was, just a guy that, right out of the gate, you know, he was almost of like a Japanese Dick Slater, in a sense, in that right out of the gate, he was good.
Yeah, there's no question. He was, you could just, like I said, you could just see this guy had potential going through the roof. New Japan sent him to Florida to get rid of him for a little while before they could bring him back. And then, you know, as we discussed, in summer of 87, when he came back for the Summer Night Fever, the 10-man tag that we've discussed, you could see that they were really getting ready to make this guy into a star. And he was doing the moonsault at the time, which I don't really think anyone was doing a moonsault like, if they were, it wasn't like that. And just an incredible area. And, you know, I'm sure he ended up ruining his knees because of it. But wow, what a tremendous performer he was. And he was definitely part of this great match. And again, this match, as great as the Funk Flair match was, the brawl afterwards just completely lights out for WCW at the time. Okay, so now the final match we're going to talk about, we are going to go to 1988, December 16th, 1988, the finals of the All Japan Tag Team Tournament. And the match that I had listed as my number 18 match of the decade, we are looking and talking about Stan Hansen and Terry Gordy versus Jinichiro Tenryu and Toshiaki Kawada. Barry, tell me what you think about this match.
And there's a lot that I think about this match. So this is the match that the next time one of your friends or a family member says, wrestling is fake, wrestling is phony, and it's stupid, this is the match you're going to show them. Because you are going to watch four guys beat the shit out of each other, and you're going to sit there and go, this is a work? These four guys lay into each other like no one's business. And so I looked this match up, and obviously, I watched this match twice, first off, because I had to continue to watch it to understand what I was seeing. Because this is at a different level of matches that we see and that you and I even talk about. This is at a different level. It's not showboating. It's not fancy maneuvers. It's not incredible flips. It is four guys beating the shit out of each other. And I did some research and I looked it up and a couple things I found. So this is the match, and it was really funny. I put in Kings Road style, and this is the match that came up to show me the definitive style of Kings Road, which is apparently is a mix of Japanese wrestling mixed with traditional American wrestling. This match rated by Dave Meltzer as 5 stars. Now, this is always a point of contention that Dave Meltzer, who is Dave Meltzer to you know, who does he think he is that he can rate a match and do it? Well, Dave Meltzer's been watching wrestling for almost 50 years at this point. He has seen hundreds of thousands of matches. I would trust Dave Meltzer's opinion. Certainly, it's an opinion. He might be biased in a certain form. At the same time, if I ever saw a 5-star match, this is it. So anyways, we'll talk about the match now a little bit as well. So these guys come right out of the gate. Again, there's not a headlock in this. There's nothing. It's four guys beating the shit out of each other. Hansen starts slapping Tenryu, and these aren't just slaps. I mean, this is full out. You know, the guy on the top row in the arena can hear this. And then Gordy does this devastating clothesline. Kawada's kind of taken out midway through the match, and obviously by design. Hansen attacks his knee, and it's interesting because Kawada goes for Hansen. Hansen's on the ring rope. Kawada goes for him, and then Hansen winds up going for Kawada's knee, destroys his knee, and it basically becomes a 2-on-1 at that stage. And it's really Tenryu taking on both men and taking on abuse like you've never seen in a pro wrestling ring. Tenryu, oh my God, unbelievable. And he does get in this very small amount of offense at the very end, but this match is, you know, at the end, there's no Tenryu finally gets pinned. It's like a mercy killing at the end when he finally gets pinned, because Hansen and Gordy, you know, we talk about who are the toughest guys and everybody says Meng and Harley Race. I got to be honest, if I was walking down an alley and, you know, and I had two guys behind me, I don't know. Hansen and Gordy, those are some pretty excellent choices right there. I love this match. Again, there are certain matches that we've said throughout the weeks that this is a match you must watch. There, you know, I think we said it with one of the female matches a couple of weeks ago, which, you know, that was more of the spectacle. And I want to say it was the hair match, and that was more of the spectacle. Wow, this match, this is the match you want to see. Incredible.
Yeah, this match is just completely off the charts as far as brutality. You know, it's like a train wreck that you're watching in slow motion and you just can't look away. So as I watch this match, you have to understand that Tenryu had recently, with the departure of Riki Choshu about a year before this, they had had to call an audible, and they, you know, the longtime team of Tsuruta and Tenryu were split up. Tenryu started his own faction and started feuding with Tsuruta. And one of the guys he took into his group was Toshiaki Kawada. And Tsuruta had his guys, which included Michiharu Misawa. Now, Misawa, on the chain of elevation of young guys, was the guy I think that Baba had always had an idea that Misawa would be the guy to eventually take over Tsuruta's legacy. And so Kawada is put in the position where he's the guy that's the other guy behind the guy that's going to be elevated. It had been that way. You know, Kawada and Misawa were both tremendous amateur wrestlers in Japan before they started training with the All Japan guys. So here, Misawa had already been elevated by this point. But here, Kawada was beginning to be elevated. He had been in a tag team with Samson Riki Fuyuki. That's how much Samson Fuyuki loved Riki Choshu. He took his damn name. And they had a really memorable feud with, I know one of them was Shiniki Nakano, and I can't remember who the other guy was, but that was like the Observer match of the year. So as a tag team wrestler, Kawada was a real big deal. But here, he was getting put in a tag team with the main event guys. And this was Toshiaki Kawada's time to shine. And this was the match where he really started becoming elevated as a main event guy. Tenryu, with the split and with the attitude he shows at the beginning of the match, he walks over and slaps Tsuruta, who's standing on the ring apron, to remind the fans of the program between the two of them, the heat between the two of them. Kind of, to put it in a modern day context, sort of a heel to a slight degree, the way that Naito is in New Japan now, sort of the guy that doesn't give a damn, and that's the vibe he gets off. So he's a rebel, and he's rebelling against a promotion. So he's kind of perceived as being the cool guy. And so the other guy I thought of, Gordy, this was post his knee injury that he had suffered, I want to say late in 86. He is literally taped almost from ankle to thigh. Because he never got his knee repaired. He blew out his knee, I want to say, like November of 86, in a car. I think it was in a car accident that involved Buddy Landell. Somehow Buddy couldn't help tripping over his own 2 feet, and he happened to be there when Gordy got hurt, and that was the reason why Gordy had to give up the UWF title. So briefly, let's poke the bear on Terry Gordy. As I was watching this match, and I started thinking about Terry Gordy, and you know, and our circle of friends who were big fans of the UWF during the glory year of 1986, you know, we always thought of Terry Gordy, smart fans thought of Terry Gordy as being our world champion, you know. And one of the most disappointing days in my fandom as a wrestling fan was the day that Terry Gordy just essentially had to hand the belt to the one-man gang to make the one-man gang the world champion because Gordy's knee was blown out. And it was just like a horrible way for Gordy's legacy as the UWF champion to end. But you look back, let's take a look at all the great tag teams that Terry Gordy has been in. We talked last week about Coco Ware and how Coco Ware was thought of as a character in the WWE, when in fact he had a great tag team with Norvell Austin, a great tag team with Bobby Eaton. How about all these guys that Terry Gordy had memorable tag team runs with? Besides Michael Hayes, his most famous tag team partner, he had a great team in Georgia with Jimmy Snuka. If you ever saw them work in Georgia on TV, they were fantastic. He had a great run with Stan Hansen as his partner. He had a great run famously with Dr. Death Steve Williams into the 90s. This guy had four tag teams that are Hall of Fame, you know, caliber tag teams that he was part of. This is a guy that I truly believe belongs in someone's Hall of Fame because he was an amazing, amazing talent. And at this point, he's essentially doing it on one knee. Hansen comes in the ring. One of the things I love is he took his hat and he throws it into the bleachers. And if you watch the crowd, the normally sedate Japanese crowd goes completely apeshit trying to get his hat. The chops that Barry mentioned by Tenryu are just brutal and so stiff. I mean, like I'm talking Wahoo McDaniel plus Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat plus. They are just laying them. And there's a sequence with Tenryu and Terry Gordy where they're just, oh my God, just eating each other's chest ups with the chops. And you know what I wrote down, Barry mentioned it. My note here is these guys are just beating the crap out of one another for a good solid 20 minutes. And you know, just tremendous, tremendous stuff. The finish match goes 24 minutes. Hansen gets the victory with a powerbomb on Tenryu. So Gordy and Hansen win the tag team tournament, the All Japan Tag Team Tournament. And I completely agree. There are definitely signs here where you can see the famous King's Road style coming to fruition here in this match. And Barry's absolutely right. If you want to watch a match that, wow, just superior talent, superior work rate, superior just moves, this was off the charts good. And, you know, wow, it's amazing. These guys, their bodies didn't break down before. That's how hard these guys are hitting one another. And, you know, you work a match like this and you need a good couple of weeks off just for your body to recover.
We got to say too, so you brought up Terry Gordy's knees and his knees, and you're 100% right. I've never seen a knee brace that basically goes up to your hip down to your ankle. So these are the largest, and they're on both knees. At the same time, this guy's putting on a 5-star match. Like, yeah. As injured as he is, he's absolutely incredible. This is going to be, where did this rank on your list?
This was number 18.
See, wow. All right, so I'm gonna pull up your list. I gotta see what numbers 1 through 17 were, because this is one. I've been watching wrestling since 1971. This may be one of the greatest matches, if not the greatest match I have ever seen. Yeah, I was literally blown away by it.
Yeah, four super talents, and like I said, the elevation of Toshiaki Kawada began here. Tremendous, tremendous talent. And, you know, the amazing, yeah, I talk about the damage, the residual damage that has to be done on these guys after having a match like this. Boy, if you look at a picture of Toshiaki Kawada now, the guy looks like he's 90 years old. It certainly took its toll.
Yeah.
You know, he's not looking good. So, okay, we're going to change directions here for our podcast now. Going to do a little movie talk. Before we get to our top five list, Barry and I want to just briefly mention a movie that both of us have recently watched. And that's a movie, I believe it's on the movie channel right now. It's a movie called London Town. And London Town is about a boy who is in a situation where his parents have split. His mom is sort of kind of a hippie, you know, free spirit. And dad has to take the responsibility of raising he and his sister. He's kind of pissed off at his dad, takes everything out on his dad. And then one day on a train, he meets a girl who turns him on to the music of The Clash. And his whole life changes. He ends up having a fateful encounter with Joe Strummer that changes his life. And Barry, I know you saw this movie, and this is a movie I really want to recommend. Amongst everything else, the movie stars Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Natasha McElhone, Doug Ray Scott. There are some names that are, you know, kind of sort of well-known. But the people that we really want to mention are Carrie Howard, who plays the young girl, and Daniel Huddlestone, who plays the young boy. And I really love it when you see young actors that completely nail it. And boy, Barry, the kids in this movie, they really nailed it.
They really did too. So I think to that point too, I was talking with my wife about this yesterday too. So we're absolutely huge fans of a British television show called Black Mirror. And there's a lot of comparability to The Twilight Zone in that it's an anthology show, but it's British. And the truth is, I don't, you know, 90% of the actors I've never seen before. So what I love about this movie is, you know, there are a few characters, and it's the adults that I recognize. I didn't know either of these kids. So I'm sitting there, and there's such a believability factor when I watch this movie that at times I forget I'm watching a movie. It's like I'm just a mirror into somebody's world. But the kids did a great job, and the whole backdrop of the Clash, to me, I just thought was great. The guy playing Joe Strummer was great. I mean, you know, Joe Strummer's not a guy that you're going to be able to nail, and certainly he's not, you know, he's doing Joe Strummer, but he's not Joe Strummer. But at the same time, I thought this story was really original. It wasn't something that I'd ever seen before, and it was really a coming-of-age story about this young boy who loses his mom, because she, as you said, she's a free-spirited hippie. Then his dad gets injured, and he's basically got to take care of his little sister and, you know, and take care of a business. And you know, I don't want to give too much away, but I highly recommend this movie. This was just a lot of fun for me.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that's great about the movie is it's a kid who, at the very beginning of the movie, is really hates his dad because he thinks his dad is, you know, because his dad is being a parent, God forbid, and his dad's not letting him get away with stuff that his mother probably would have let him get away with as the free spirit. And he goes to seek out his mother and sort of really discovers what his mother is and realizes the choices that his father had to make for him to, you know, grow up and get the benefit of all the things. And he realizes that the father's not really the bad guy in the relationship. And it's, you know, that makes it a really interesting come of age. Okay, so very quick, give me your top three Clash songs right off the top of your head.
Oi, Joy, tough. So Clash City Rockers is number one, always. Guns of Brixton and Magnificent Seven.
Okay, I'm going, God, it was a real pain in my ass to leave off White Right. I love that song, but I'm going to go number three, London Calling. Number two, Train in Vain. Number one, because here we go with the topics. When I first was trying to come up with my theme song to Breaking Kayfabe, I mentioned last week that besides Spirit of Radio by Rush, I had wanted to do Modern Love by David Bowie. Coming in third for my original choice as the theme song for Breaking Kayfabe, This Is Radio Clash. Boy, do I love that song. Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, now it's time for our top five. Folks, we are going to discuss our top five Robert De Niro films, our favorite Robert De Niro films. Again, this is not what we think the best Robert De Niro film is. So all you Raging Bull fans out there, just calm yourself down and get your panties out of a bunch. We're going to talk about our favorite top five Robert De Niro films. Barry, give me number five.
Yeah, bring on the hate that we're leaving off the Raging Bull. So
we're turning into Tully Blanchard here on the podcast.
Exactly. Bring it on. We expect it. We know we're going to get it. Maybe we deserve it. I don't know. So as I mentioned, I will not be bringing up The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. I will give out a shout out to a movie that he made with, I believe it was Uma Thurman, called Mad Dog and Glory. And it was this cute little small movie. I don't remember. I just remember going into the theater and liking it. But getting to the topic on hand, my number five favorite Robert De Niro movie is 1984's Once Upon a Time in America. And I have a personal connection to this movie in the sense that I was I had some really bad virus in 1984. It was the fall of 1984, and I was pretty much laid up in bed for a week. And, you know, it was one of these things where you would sleep in the day and then you'd wake up and you'd go back to sleep. So I was up at around 2 o'clock in the morning and I was wide awake after sleeping and being awake. And I put on Once Upon a Time in America. And, for the next 2 hours, it's almost 4 hours. It's like 227 minutes. I stayed awake and I watched the entire movie. And I'll never forget that. And it's really, literally almost a 4 hour movie. It's, directed by Sergio Leone. And Jeff, you're a huge Western fan. So you know who Sergio Leone is. Once Upon a Time in the West, Fistful of Dollars, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly for a few dollars more. This guy was primarily the guy that really came up with these spaghetti westerns. And this was actually his last movie. This was the last movie that he made. But this movie stars Robert De Niro. He plays an older gangster named Noodles, David Aronson, that returns to New York where he had a career in the 20s and 30s. And all of his friends are basically dead. But he feels like something's missing. And it's all told in flashbacks. And it follows Noodles, you know, as a tough kid in a Jewish slum growing up on the Lower East Side of New York. And then he became a bootlegger and a mafia boss. And, you know, it just goes through his entire life between the mafia stuff and the loves of his life. And it's such a compelling work of art. And the beauty of this film, I got to say, from my perspective, was I never saw it in the theaters. And apparently when it was released in the theaters, they chopped off 90 minutes and it was this huge fucking mess. Just mess of a movie. You know, the critics weren't kind to it. By comparison, when this movie was released in the theaters in 1984, it made $5.3 million in the theaters. To give you an idea, Ghostbusters, which was the number one movie of the year in 1984, made $238 million. So that's an astounding disparity. But this movie is fantastic. You know, it's got, there's so much to it. If you can see it, definitely see it on DVD. And the supporting cast in this is fantastic. And actually a couple actors I'll point out. James Woods, before he became this raging fucking asshole that he is currently, James Woods was a really, really solid actor. And he's great in this movie. Joe Pesci, obviously Joe Pesci and De Niro have worked, they worked again, which we can talk about. Burt Young from the Rocky movies is in this. Danny Aiello. Treat Williams, Darlan Flugel. Do you have any idea who Darlan Flugel is?
I do not.
Gotcha. So she was in a movie I referenced last week, which was during the car chases, which I guess was 2 weeks ago or last week. I always forget, but it was 2 weeks ago. It was she was in To Live and Die in L.A., and she plays the stripper who has the relationship with William Peterson. And there's a topless scene in that movie. She's fantastic. I bring her up only she recently passed away within the last month or so of an Alzheimer's related disease. And I think she was like 60. So just, you know, very, very young. And then another actor that I'll bring up is Richard Ferrangi. And Richard Ferrangi was a former guy who was in the mafia and was in my favorite movie of all time, Repo Man, when he played the security guard. And he's also going to be in a movie that I'll be mentioning with De Niro coming up later. So Once Upon a Time in America is not a movie you can sit down, you can watch. And you know, again, it's almost 4 hours. It's a masterpiece. It is one of those that if you've got the time, lock the door, take the phone off the hook, watch it. You'll be happy you did. I love this movie. It might be higher up on my list if I could watch it more frequently. Given it 4 hours, I can't. But I love this movie. Have you ever seen it?
Yes. And I was fortunate enough to not watch the chopped, edited version that you mentioned. I saw the extended version. And if you are going to watch this movie, what's the time on the chopped version? Is it like maybe 2 hours? You got to get the one that's like at least three and a half hours. That's the complete opus that really tells it. And the other one I want to ask you, the young girl in the beginning of the story, wasn't that Jennifer Connelly playing
that's
the young
Jennifer
girl?
Jennifer Connelly. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, looks absolutely, you know, you can tell she's going to end up being a beautiful woman. But yeah, no, she's tremendous in that.
What about Elizabeth McGovern? It's a name that nobody ever talks about. And I thought
great
she was
actress.
Beautiful. Yeah.
I thought she was right. She was Elizabeth McGovern, famous for being in Ordinary People. She was in a couple of – she always played the teen girlfriend a lot. But, yeah, she was a really beautiful girl. Still does some acting.
Racing with the Moon.
Yes.
Racing with the Moon with Sean Penn. And
Ragtime. She was in Ragtime,
Ragtime.
Too.
She was great.
Yeah. But so my number five movies, I am going a little bit outside the box here because, you know, traditionally De Niro usually plays the bad guy in a lot of his best movies, you know. So I decided to do a little swerve here, and I went with the movie where he's kind of the good guy, and the bad guy is the actor that wrote the story that's called A Bronx Tale. And it's about a father who is concerned because his young son has started hanging out or being influenced by the local mob boss, who's played by Palminteri, who's tremendous in the role. And Robert De Niro plays a bus driver, and he sees his world starting to spiral, sees his son, losing his grip as a father on his son, and wants to keep his son away from the influence of this mob boss, and how he goes about doing it. And there's a tremendous scene where De Niro goes and confronts the mob boss, and he says, you know, I know what you can do to me. I know everything that you're, you know, about, but you're wrong. You're wrong about this. And the mob boss kind of like, I give you a slap. And then when he walks away, one of the underlings says, you want me to take care of him? And he's looking out the window as De Niro is walking away with his young son. And he says, no, let him be, let him be. And De Niro has earned the respect of the mob boss for coming and making him face the fact that what he was doing with this young kid was wrong. So I know you've seen this movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely too. And it's, you know, here's the thing. This is a fantastic movie. I was blown away, I think, when I saw it originally. But I think the real story here was the actor who played the young kid, Lilio Brancato Jr., or Lilio Brancato the second or third. I forget exactly, but you know what happened to this kid, right?
Why don't you remind me?
Gotcha. So he was part of, acting roles dried up after a few years, and he, they were committing a robbery, and they shot and I believe killed a cop, and he went to jail for, I guess, close to a decade.
Wow.
And then got it. Yeah. So that right there was, you know, again, the irony of this entire movie is about this kid trying to keep him straight so he doesn't get into trouble. And in real life, this kid winds up going to jail for close to a decade. So it's a great movie. And, you know, Chaz Palminteri's made a career out of this. This was on Broadway, and he does this one-man play, which basically references this. So an entire career really came from this movie. But it's an excellent movie. It's not De Niro's biggest work by any stretch. But at the same time, it's powerful.
This is not loud, over the top De Niro. This is quiet, more reserved. And I think you have to give him his credit for today. It would have been easy for Palminteri to give De Niro the role of the mob boss and, you know, take the role of it. But, you know, I think in switching the roles and Palminteri keeping the role of the mob boss and De Niro taking the more reserved role of the parent was a real interesting casting choice. And I really think it paid off. So, that being said, number four, Barry.
Yeah, so number four is The Godfather Part Two. So, look, let's be honest. This is one of the great movies of all time. And if I've got to sit here and explain what The Godfather Part Two is about, I should probably disown you right now.
If he has to explain that, folks, why are you listening at this
point? It's The Godfather, for crying out loud. And you know, I there's a couple of things I'm going to pull up here, which are interesting to me. I always like this interesting side shit, but, you know, De Niro won a best supporting actor for this role and should have. And Godfather 2 is interesting because, I think Godfather 2 is better than the first Godfather. So I'm going to be curious what you think in just a second, but this movie basically is two films put into one, and it's a prequel and it's a sequel. And, you know, the prequel is, it's basically Robert De Niro is Vito Corleone, who we knew was Marlon Brando in the first Godfather, coming from a Sicilian childhood, to founding, you know, this family in New York. And then the second part of it is the sequel aspect, and it's the rise of Michael Corleone, the Al Pacino character, becoming the new Don, of the family after everything happened with the attempt on his life. So I've always thought Godfather 2, in my opinion, was a better film than Godfather 1. What do you think, Jeff?
Absolute blasphemy. No, that being said, I enjoy of the two movies, and we're not talking about Godfather 3 for obvious reasons. Of the two movies, my favorite part of the two movies is the De Niro character of the young Vito Corleone. That I really like, and I probably, you know, and again, this is all subjective opinion. You know, I know that, you know, there's some people that love the part of Godfather 2 with Michael Corleone. That's probably of the two movies my least. So if you break it down into a couple different parts, I'm going the De Niro Vito Corleone part, then the original Godfather, then the Michael Corleone part with Al Pacino, and it's all brilliance. Don't get me wrong. I'm not poo-pooing the second part of The Godfather. It's all brilliant. But my personal favorite part is the Robert De Niro part with the young Vito Corleone coming to power, taking on the local mob boss. Just absolute. That was the most compelling part of the movie, in my opinion.
We're in complete agreement with this, too. His relationship with the young Clemenza, played by Bruno Kirby, to me, is such a highlight on so many levels. So I want to give a shout-out, two things with this. Harry Dean Stanton, also from my favorite movie of all time, Repo Man, plays an FBI agent. But Carmine Caridi plays Carmine Rosado. So Carmine Caridi is a guy that was in a million movies. And we discussed him recently last week. He played Ed in Summer Rental, and Ed was the guy who was married to the woman who kept lifting up her top and showing her new breasts. And he was also in The Money Pit. He was in every gangster and mafia movie. So I did a little research on Carmine Caridi, thinking that, okay, he was great in Money Pit, which I remember. Whatever happened to Carmine Caridi? As it turns out, Carmine Caridi is one of only two people to ever be kicked out of the Motion Picture Academy. You know who the second one is,
wow,
obviously, right?
That's pretty amazing, actually. That's a pretty high standard kind of, he's got there. No, who was the other one?
The other one is Harvey Weinstein.
Well,
I'm saying, which is kind of like, it's kind of like, how current is this? So apparently Carmine Caridi in 2004 was, and I'm not making this up, was sending his loaner copies of movies that were screeners that were up for awards. He was sending them to a guy who was making copies, and I guess it was this, you know, this ring that they were running, and they were making hand over foot. So the other guy was arrested. He died of a heart attack, I believe, in jail. Carmine Caridi was basically kicked out of the Academy. Again, only two people have ever been kicked out. And I read an article on him, and he's 83 or 84 now, still lives in Hollywood, and basically says, yeah, you know, I made a mistake, and I get that, but my career didn't suffer. And as I look at it, his career really fucking suffered, because after 2004, he's only been in two projects, which are really two smaller projects. So I just thought that was interesting. You know, again, we could talk about The Godfather all day. I'm in 100% agreement with you. To me, it's, you know, and Al Pacino is a guy that's polarizing to me. There are certain times I really like Pacino, and there's other times I really don't like Pacino. And a lot of people, Scent of a Woman, is a movie that, for whatever reason, he annoys the shit out of me with the hoo-ha all the time in Scent of a Woman. I just, for whatever reason, I don't connect with it.
Well, I have to say, one thing I heard about the older Pacino is that as Pacino got older in his roles, he began shouting his lines.
And it's obvious. It's really obvious. And that's a great point, because the older movies that he did 40 and 45 years ago, I love, but I have a hard time watching him now. I don't connect with it, but I do think he did a great job as Michael Corleone. I mean, you know, if anything. So again, Godfather 2, I love it. I'm glad you love it. And if you're listening to this and you've never seen it, come on. You got to get out and you got to listen. You got to watch this now.
Okay. My number four, it came down to a choice between Casino or Goodfellas. I picked Casino. And the reason I picked Casino is because I felt Goodfellas was more of a Ray Liotta film than a Robert De Niro film, whereas Casino is more of a Robert De Niro film in my book. Both just great. Again, I don't mean to poo-poo here. Goodfellas. How can you not watch Goodfellas when it pops on the TV late at night? You gotta check out at least some of it, you know? Casino is my number four film. Much like Goodfellas, one of the things that was so interesting to me was the use of the tracking camera that director Martin Scorsese used. In Goodfellas, he used it to go through a restaurant. And this one, he used it to take you in to the money room at the casino and to watch them skimming money for the mob. And the tale of where the trail of the money and where the money went is got to be one of the great scenes, not just of Robert De Niro films, in movie history. Much like that famous scene from Goodfellas, where they're tracking Ray Liotta and his girlfriend as they go through the kitchen. Just an amazing scene. And so was this thing in the casino. So let me ask you, Barry, since you're Mr. Trivia, what record did Casino hold until 1999?
The most F-bombs ever dropped in a movie.
435 times the word fuck was used in this movie, which was only beaten out in 1999 by the movie Summer of Sam, which is a great movie, by the way. That was subsequently beaten out by The Wolf of Wall Street, which had close to 600 uses of the F-bomb. Boy, later on, sometime when we talk about podcasts, we talk about movies, we'll have to discuss The Wolf of Wall Street and the fact that my brother took my father to see that movie thinking, oh, he's going to see a movie about Wall Street, and how completely outraged my father was at the language in the movie. Anyway, getting back to this movie, what a tremendous movie. Just Scorsese at his zenith here. Here's a guy that was great in the movie that we don't talk about as an actor. For other reasons, he's absolutely first rate. Don Rickles is tremendous as the casino pit boss in this movie. So many. James Woods Ginson is in this one. Joe Pesci. How scummy was Joe Pesci in this movie? And Sharon Stone, this might be her best performance ever as the slutty wife. Just an unbelievable, unbelievable movie. Unbelievable look at the way the mob controlled the casinos in Las Vegas back in the day. Barry, tell me what you think about this movie.
Yeah, so how scummy is Joe Pesci in every movie? It's probably right, because he really is. And Sharon Stone, and I remember towards the end of the movie, I really wanted to punch Sharon Stone right in the face because I hated her so much towards the end. But that's a real – there's the poll you have to put up on the in the Facebook group this week right there. Is it Casino or Goodfellas? Because – and I imagine the majority of people are going to say Goodfellas, but at the same time – I think Casino is a better movie. I may get a little heat over that one as well.
Casino's got more meat on the bones, but
yeah.
Goodfellas is
a little more complex. It's a little more layered. Yeah.
Goodfellas is more of a I don't want to say a pop. It's like the difference between a good album cut and the one that went to the top 40. You know, I mean, yeah, right. Both good songs, but you know, there's more to the album cut song. But yeah, no, this was such a good movie, and there's so many great performances in it. Frank Vincent, here's a great character actor. LQ Jones is in this.
The great LQ.
Yeah, just a guy that was in so many great movies and does such a great job.
Chuck Norris movie. What was that one? He was in a movie with Chuck.
Drawing a blank on that. Yeah, no, I know the one you're talking about. Now it's gonna pop up in my head like
with
half
David
hour.
Carradine. He's in it with David Carradine.
Where he drives
what was
the
name
truck,
of that movie?
Where the truck is buried and he pops out from underneath the ground, right? Is that the one? Yeah. Chuck, that's another topic we do. Top five Chuck Norris movies of all time.
LQ Jones movies. Shit.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sitting here reading a book about Steven Seagal movies, and now LQ Jones comes up. So, okay, give us your number three, Barry.
So my number three. You don't make up for your sins in church. You do it in the streets. You do it at home. The rest is bullshit, and you know it. So, my number three Robert De Niro movie, favorite Robert De Niro movie is Mean Streets. 1973, Robert De Niro plays Johnny Boy. He's a small-town gambler. He owes money to all these different loan sharks. He's reckless. He's crazy. And he's best friends with Charlie, who's this young kind of Italian-American. He works with the mob, but he's responsible, and he's trying to do well for himself. And it's this great relationship between Charlie Harvey Keitel and Johnny Boy, who's played by Robert De Niro. And I love this movie, too. So this was the first movie, between the collaboration between Scorsese and De Niro, their first time. They have made 9 films together, and the 9th one is actually scheduled to be released next year. It's going to be called The Irishman. But for me, this movie is great. 2 things. One is, this is such an accurate depiction of New York City, which I just think, you know, to me, it blew me away. And New York is kind of even the star of this movie in a lot of ways. But this is based off of, I read this book on Scorsese years ago, and Scorsese had made 2 films, 2 or 3 films prior to this. I think it was 2 films, and they were both pieces of shit. And a lot of it was he was following the directives of other people. One was Boxcar Bertha. which was given to him by Roger Corman, if I'm correct. So, you know, it just, he had done these movies, but they weren't his movies. And this is the first movie that is his. And it really was depicting his life when he was growing up in Little Italy in New York City. So I love that aspect of it. But the relationship between Keitel and De Niro, and obviously those two are, that's two of people when you think of New York City actors, Harvey Keitel, who really, to me, tremendously underrated. You know, just great. But the dialogue in this movie, and I just mentioned, you know, a little bit of it. The dialogue in this movie is just, it's real. You know, at times you forget that you're seeing actors, and you got two guys, and I don't know how many times the F-bomb was dropped in this movie as well, but it's got to be up there. Have you ever seen Mean Streets?
Yes, I have. Yeah, great movie. I loved it.
It was really good.
And it's young, gritty De Niro, young, gritty Harvey Keitel before he became the bad lieutenant and started showing up in Tarantino films. But no, yeah, very good movie.
Yeah, too. And, you know, and De Niro's got this line, too. And he goes, "I fuck you right where you breathe because I don't give two shits about you or anybody else." He's just, there's such a conviction in De Niro's lines, and he's great here because he's so reckless and he's so crazy. And it's, and again, I just think the relationship between these two is just, it's just unbelievable. So, and this is one of those that, you know, everybody focuses on the other film, which, you know, I'm not going to mention because I know it's on one of our lists coming up, but the other film that these two made together, which is a great film. However, I think Mean Streets deserves a serious look.
Yeah, Mean Streets is like another film that I think we're going to discuss in a little bit. You kind of feel like you need to take a shower after the movie's over, you know? And, you know, it's, but it's a great film. Okay, my number three. Got to do a little controversy here because this is not a movie that, when you think of Robert De Niro films right off the top of your head, one of the films that probably doesn't pop into the top of your head that really should, that more people should see because I think it's really incredibly underrated, excuse me, is a movie called Ronin. It came out in 1998. He plays a freelancing U.S. intelligence agent who's basically assigned to track down a briefcase. It's got the old MacGuffin. They never show you what's in the suitcase, but that's what they're after. We briefly discussed the movie Ronin when we were talking about our favorite car chase movies. And this stars Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, Natasha McElhone. I'm butchering that name, sorry. Stellan Skarsgård, Sean Bean, and Michael Lonsdale. Michael Lonsdale was in the James Bond movie Moonraker. He played Hugo Drax. And this is a... It's just a really interesting story to me. These guys are basically soldiers of fortune who are, you know, who are out there, you know, they're paid to do a job. They have no connection to one another at all. And they're asked to come together, you know, to go on the search for this briefcase. There's all kind of different backstabbing and, you know, double switcheroos. And there's a really great, but in amongst all this chaos, there's this really great scene that I love where, Robert De Niro and Michael Lonsdale are sitting, and Michael Lonsdale is painting tiny figurines. That's like his hobby, the character's hobby. And so De Niro says, ask him, like, what is this you're doing? And Michael Lonsdale's character, his name is Jean-Pierre, says, "The 47 Ronin, do you know it?" And De Niro says, "No." He says, "47 samurai whose master were betrayed and killed by another lord. They became Ronin, masterless samurai, disgraced by another man's treachery. For 3 years, they plotted, pretending to be thieves, mercenaries, even madmen, that I didn't have time to do. And then one night they struck, slipping into the castle of their lord's betrayer and killing him." And De Niro says, "Nice, I like that. It's my kind of job." He says, "There's something else. All 47 of them committed seppuku, ritual suicide, in the courtyard of the castle." De Niro says, "Well, that I don't like so much." And it's in amongst all this chaos, it's a great little quiet scene that is part of why this movie is so great, because in amongst the chaos, there's time for this little quiet scene that is just completely riveting. So tell me what you thought about this movie, Barry.
Yeah. And I should say too, this is actually playing on cable this month, and it's in heavy, heavy rotation. I just, you know, I've watched it but I don't know if I ever truly watched it up until maybe about a week or 2 weeks ago, right after we discussed the car chase scene, and I actually sat down and I watched it. And you just mentioned Natasha McElhone, and she's in London Town. So this is a great movie. This is a movie that is it's high energy, it's high octane. You will not be bored. There's great acting all the way throughout, but this is one of those that after I watched the movie, it made me question my top five car chases and say, shit, maybe I should have tried to include this on my list because it was fantastic. It's a fantastic movie. De Niro, this is a really, really good role for him. And, he's made some choices. And I'm trying to find the right way to say this, but he's made some choices in the last 10 or 15 years, which are extremely questionable. I think that Rocky and Bullwinkle one is certainly one you can point to, but he's done a lot of comedy, Meet the Fockers and Fock This, whatever these movies were called. And Ronin to me is a movie where, he kind of got back to his roots just a little bit. Because, there's this edge to him in this movie that I liked a lot. So I love this movie. I would, I'm questioning why I never sat and fully watched it up until about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And what's great about this is I don't know that he says 100 words in this movie. A lot of it is he's very, very quiet, reserved guy. He says so much with his facial expressions and facial reactions to things that are being said, but, just a very forgotten great performance by Robert De Niro. So, okay, give me your number two.
Yeah, two. And I just want to say, too, I said it was Boxcar Bertha. That was the Roger Corman film. And before somebody corrects me, as inevitably happens every week, that was not the film. So my number two is what I referenced with Mean Streets. This is the second collaboration with Harvey Keitel, Robert De Niro and Martin Scorsese. And there's a great, there's something that's iconic, much like Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Terminator, I'll Be Back. This is it. You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah? Okay. I'm talking about Taxi Driver. So this is the iconic, in my opinion, this is the iconic Robert De Niro tour de force. This is the movie that catapulted Robert De Niro into superstardom. He had already been in The Godfather Part II, but this is the movie that really said, okay, you know what? That B-list shit, whatever, we're done now. You're A-list guy. This is incredible. He plays Travis Bickle, doesn't play Travis Heckle or Travis Rains. Cheap pop right there.
Boom.
He plays Travis Bickle. Boom, right? He plays Travis Bickle, and he basically is this slightly psychotic guy who is slipping into full psychosis, suffering from insomnia. He's a loner, and he takes a job as a New York City cab driver, and he drives at night. And the more that he's out there and the more that he sees in New York City, the more he becomes detached from reality, and he's dreaming of cleaning up the city, and he said, oh, it'll rain, it'll wash all the scum away. And he meets this really kind of sexy, and she definitely was very sexy back then, a campaign worker who's played by Sybil Shepherd, and becomes attached to her, and then he's plotting to assassinate the presidential candidate who she's working for. And at the same time, he wants to rescue a 12-year-old street prostitute played by a very young Jodie Foster, and save her from her pimp who's played by Harvey Keitel. So, holy shit. This is such a great movie. Every scene in this movie is great. I mean, he takes Betsy out on a date and he takes her to see a porno movie and she's repulsed by it. And he's shocked that she's repulsed by it. And then he tries to woo her back. But the scene with Harvey Keitel, who plays this pimp named Sport, and, I don't want to spoil a movie that's 42 years old, but I would, after I sat down, and I made this list, and I made this list up over the last couple of days. I was like, you know what? I'm going to sit and I'm going to watch Taxi Driver Saturday night again because it's that good. This is one of those movies, and you just said this a couple of minutes ago as well with The Wolf of Wall Street, but this is one of those movies that I saw with my mother in a revival house, and I saw it for the first time with my mother, and there's scenes in here where this is not safe for work at the moment, but there are scenes in here where Robert De Niro is having a conversation with Jodie Foster talking about her pussy. And I sat there right next to my mother, and I swear to God, that was one of the worst cringeworthy moments of my life. So I love this movie. There's so many great lines. You're only as healthy as you feel, which he says several different times in this movie. So I think it's great. This to me, and watching his slip into psychosis, where eventually he gets the mohawk and he's staring at himself in the mirror, just so good. This is why De Niro is considered one of our greatest actors, 100%. So what do you think, Jeff?
Well, here's a little surprise for the listeners. When Barry and I first discussed what our top five was going to be, Barry told me that he was going to have another movie on his list. So Taxi Driver is my number two also, because I thought you were going Jackie Brown, but that's another story. The performance by Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver might be one of the greatest performances in the history of cinema. I think he's better here than he is in Raging Bull.
He's
absolutely amazing in his portrayal of a man slipping into psychosis. You know, they talk famously about how Heath Ledger, when he made The Dark Knight and portrayed the Joker, allowed some of the psychosis of the character almost to overtake him. He was that in tune with the performance and what do they call it? The Stanislavski method or something like that. And where you just become the person that you're portraying in order to convey the message to the audience. And Robert De Niro's character in this movie, as he slowly becomes more and more psychotic, it's absolutely spellbinding to watch. And I'm going to read one of the quotes here. I'm not that good. I don't memorize lines like De Niro did, but here's the way that one of his lines went as he's driving the cab and he narrates as the cab is slowly going through the streets of New York. May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, sometimes even 8 in the morning, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. All the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday, a real rain will come and wash all the scum off the streets. I go all over. I take people to the Bronx, Brooklyn. I take them to Harlem. I don't care. Don't make no difference to me. It does to some. Some would even take the spooks. Don't make no difference to me. And he grabs you by the throat and makes you watch him and makes you listen to him. And that Scorsese, I mean, it was like Scorsese reached deep inside De Niro and pulled this performance out of him. And it's absolutely spellbinding. And wow, just an amazing, amazing. This isn't a movie. This isn't film. This is like a piece of art. Now, that being said, it's kind of a dirty piece of art because there's a lot of really disturbing, the 12-year-old prostitute, the very graphic murder scenes that involves one of the characters late in the movie. Just watching the psychosis envelop Travis Bickle is a very thing that's intended for mature audiences, shall we say. This is not something you want to sit with your kids and watch because, boy, will you have a lot of questions to answer after this movie's done. But it's a fantastic, fantastic movie.
Yeah, and so you said something, and I'm going to back you up and agree with you 100%. This is the finest piece of work that Robert De Niro has ever done. It surpasses Raging Bull. He was great in Raging Bull, but this is something that has to be seen. And part of it, you just touched on it, is the fact that it's the way that he says the lines. And he's saying these lines essentially to himself, and he's got another one too, which is one of my favorites, and I wrote this down. listen, you fuckers, you screwheads, here is a man who would not take it anymore, a man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is a man who stood up. And he's so good, and he says it with such conviction that you sit here and you watch it and you realize you're seeing greatness. Now, that being said, another thing you just said, which is absolutely correct, this is a dirty movie in the fact that you almost have to shower after you watch it because it is gritty, it is grimy, and it's dirty. That being said, I would say this is one of the greatest American movies of all time.
No question about it. So, Barry, since we both agreed on number two, since you kayfabe me about your choice of Jackie Brown, we're going to skip over that.
We talked about that, remember? We talked about that.
Yeah, no, but I thought that was going to be your second choice, not Taxi Driver.
No, we said that we were going to save Jackie Brown for the Tarantino deal.
Okay.
Remember that one? We said we would save that for Tarantino.
Well, let the listeners decide if you kayfabe me, Rose. Give me your number one film of Robert De Niro of all time.
So my number one film of Robert De Niro of all time is one of my top 20 movies of all time. And it's a movie that's very, very special to me, and I'm going to tell you why. So in 1988, when this movie was released, I was dating a young lady who was from Germany. And she had come over to the U.S., and she was here for a month. These Europeans come over here on vacation, and they stay for a full month, which is unbelievable to me. I like that. I think that's great. So I was fairly irresponsible at that time, and we were dating, and she was going to come back and move in with me. And I was living in Miami Beach at the time, so she was going to come back. We were going to move in together, and when she left, I was very conflicted. I was like, yeah, you know, do I want this? Do I not want this? Well, I saw this movie. I walked out of the theater and I said, well, you know what? That ends that. This movie, for some reason, completely changed the way and was like, what am I, out of my fucking mind? I want this girl to come live with me? Am I crazy? So that from that aspect of it, this movie, for some reason, just did something to me. But it's 1988's Midnight Run. And it is... I love this movie, and it's awesome. You know, it's funny. You and I were talking just a few minutes ago about the word fuck, and this movie also, you know, this movie 132 times, which I think puts it in the top 30 or top 40 of all time. It's 126 minutes long, which literally gives you every 1.4 minutes the word fuck or something like that. So. That's absolutely incredible when you stop and think about it. But this movie, De Niro plays an ex-cop turned bounty hunter named Jack Walsh, and he's offered $100,000 to bring this accountant, who was a mob accountant and embezzled money from the mob, Jonathan the Duke Mardukas, played by Charles Grodin. He's got to take him on a midnight run, which is this easy run from New York to L.A., drop him off, and he gets $100,000. Well, of course, nothing's that easy, and it turns into this cross-country chase. Jack Walsh and the Duke have to avoid and evade the FBI, local authorities, and the mob, because the mob's trying to kill him, and also another bounty hunter, Marvin Dorfler. So this movie to me has got everything. There's great lines. There's a scene with Marvin Dorfler in the first 5 or 10 minutes, and there's this guy, Dorfler's eating a sandwich, and this guy is handcuffed to the sink in a bathroom, and Dorfler looks at the guy and goes, hey, scumbag, and the guy in the bathroom goes, the name's Carmine, fucko. Dorfler looks at him and goes, yeah, well, today, Carmine's your lucky day. And he lets him go because he's going to look for somebody else, obviously. So I this movie, the story to me is great. The relationship in this movie between De Niro and Charles Grodin, it's right up there. And I think my favorite pairing of all time, and God knows I reference it every single episode, Jeff Bridges, John Goodman, and The Big Lebowski, this is probably my favorite because their dialogue, which is always like, shut the fuck up, kind of like what John Goodman was doing to Donnie in The Big Lebowski. But Dennis Farina plays the head of the mob, Jimmy Serrano, who is responsible, really, for getting De Niro kicked off the force. Philip Baker Hall, Jeff, one of your favorite actors of all time, he plays Serrano's lawyer, Sidney, And there's a scene in there, too, where Farina is talking. He goes, Sydney, shut the fuck up or I'm going to bash you over the head with this phone. John Ashton, who most people know from Beverly Hills Cop, plays Dorfler. Richard Ferengi, the name that I've brought up a little bit earlier, plays Tony Darvo. And Robert Miranda plays his sidekick, Joey, otherwise known as Moron Number One and Moron Number Two. And this movie was directed by Martin Brest. Martin did Beverly Hills Cop, Scent of a Woman, Meet Joe Black, did some huge movies. In 15 years, though he's a fairly relatively young guy, his last movie was 2003's Gigli, which apparently completely devastated and destroyed his career. So this is my number one Robert De Niro movie. Is it his best movie? I don't know. Could I watch Midnight Run on an endless loop the rest of my life? Absolutely.
Well, it is a great movie, and it's. I think this is the first movie that De Niro actually did in way of a slightly comedic role, because there are parts of this movie that are strictly an action film. And then you have, the dialogue between him and Charles Grodin that is very funny. And we had never seen De Niro, basically cracking wise as part of a comedic performance. So this was something that no one had seen. And it was a nice, refreshing change of pace. And I think it really extended his career. There's no question, doing the movies with Billy Crystal and the analyze this, analyze that. His career started going down, but he was still pulling in money doing those comedic roles. And he made a good, good film choice because the other roles had started drying up. But this one is very funny. And it's also, like most De Niro films, seemingly, not safe to sit and watch with your 10 or 11-year-old kid either. So, but no, tremendous fun, great supporting cast. You're absolutely right on that. And lots of fun.
Do you remember the scene where Charles Grodin is doing an impression of Jack Walsh? And I think they're on the train. They're in one of the cars, and he's like, so, yeah, I'm going to shut the fuck up, Duke. He does this impression of him that lasts for a couple of minutes, and it's just hysterical. And Charles Grodin was one of these guys that, and if you see him now, he's a real old man now. He's up there in age. But I always thought, he made some movies prior to this. He was in several movies. He did the one with Dan Aykroyd. He was the original, what was the one with Sybil Shepherd, The Heartbreak Kid? He was in that. So he had a career, but I always thought this was going to extend his career, give him a new career to a new audience. And it didn't. And I was just kind of shocked by it because he was so good in this.
He made a career after this. He did a lot of those Disney films with the big dog. Where he played the,
you're
he played
right.
the, and I can't even remember
Beethoven,
the name of the
movie. Beethoven.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was his way of extending his career. So, all right. Are you ready
good
for
point.
My number one? Ready for my number one, Barry?
Let's bring it on.
So the other day I'm sitting in court, and I have an attorney friend of mine come in, and he says, so what's going on? How's the show going? I told him what our topic was this week. And I said, so give me your number one De Niro film. And I believe he might've said Raging Bull or Taxi Driver. And he says, what's yours? And I gave him my choice. And he says, what, are you kidding me? And I said, nope. My favorite Robert De Niro film of all time is about a group of professional bank robbers starting to feel the heat from the police. From 1995, it's Michael Mann's epic crime drama, Heat. And holy crap, what a cast. Pacino, De Niro, Val Kilmer, when he was still great. John Voight, you had Tom Sizemore, Wes Studi, Ted Levine, who's best known for being the, he puts the lotion in the basket.
Hannibal Lecter, Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. Dennis Haysbert. This is just an amazing cast. And I think personally, this is saying a lot, this might be John Voight's best performance as he plays like the scummy crime boss in this movie. But wow, the best part of this movie that I could watch over and over again is the actual filming of the bank robbery, which is done so well. And so, I'll tell you what happened. When this movie first came out on DVD, I went over to a buddy of mine's house, and this is when DVD players were first the rage and first coming out, and he had gotten a stereo surround sound, and he said, oh, you want to see how this sounds? And I said, sure. And he popped the tape in, and he skipped ahead to the bank robbery to where the shooting started. And we just got this cacophony of rifle or, you know, or I don't know if they're M1s or M16s. I don't know guns. And they're firing us, boom, 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 boom. And you could just hear it echoing throughout his living room. And I said, holy crap, this is unbelievable. It's what made me get a DVD player and a surround sound in my house because it was so good. And the filming of the bank robbery and the use of them using firearms apparently is so well done that apparently in Marine Corps training, they show incoming recruits this film to show them how to properly unload and load a magazine into a weapon. I mean, that's unbelievable to me. And now that's the noisy good scene I like. I'll tell you the quiet great scene that I like is with Ashley Judd and Val Kilmer. There's a scene, excuse me, late in the movie where Val Kilmer is trying to come back to his wife, Ashley Judd, and the police are waiting for Val Kilmer to come back. And he pulls up on the street, and Ashley Judd is looking out the window, and she sees him, and she knows if he comes in the house, he's going to be arrested. And she does this very subtle wave of the hand, which lets him know as he's looking up in the window that it's not good. You know, don't come up. And Val Kilmer turns his car and drives away from his wife and family because he knows he'll go to prison otherwise. And, you know, a lot of people, I just love that scene. And a lot of people talk about how this was the first movie that ever put De Niro and Pacino together in a scene. And it's a great scene where they're sitting at a diner talking about police work versus crime. You know, he doesn't arrest them. It's a real interesting discussion of criminality, I guess, you know, and the thought process behind police and criminals. And that's the scene that everyone talks about. But there are other tremendous scenes throughout this movie. It's a great, great film. Great action movie. Epic. Epic. That's all I can say, Barry.
Yeah, I like Heat a lot, too. And I'll tell you, so the star of Heat to me is the director. It's Mann. This is a beautiful movie. And he's, you know, Michael Mann was primarily known as the guy behind Miami Vice. You know, and he's great with music. He's great with visuals, with lights. He sets tones and moods. And that's what I get. This is a really moody film as well. And I remember seeing Heat in the theaters. And I know the scene you're talking about, De Niro and Pacino, too, because when you see it, you kind of get the goosebumps, man. You're like, holy shit. That's a pretty intense scene. Having the two of them right there. So this is an excellent movie. And it's not one that I think I considered in my top five, but after just hearing you talk about it, possible reconsideration right there.
So you know, the thing is, Michael Mann, you're absolutely right. He's more than just Miami Vice. He did the original Manhunter from 1986.
Right, which I also talked about either last week or the week before when we were talking about To Live and Die in L.A. and the original Manhunter. So you know what? I would – and that's the Michael Mann trademark is if you look at Heat, you look at the original Manhunter and Miami Vice, there is this theme of where he plays kind of somber music with these dark, like, lighting tones. He's great. He's underrated as an – you know, and I know that there was a lot of – criticism given to him years ago, and I don't think it was with Heat, it was with something else, where that he was too visual, he's too stylistic, there's not enough substance to it, where I completely disagree with that, where I think that he adds to his films with that.
I'll tell you another great movie that he was the producer of that's real underrated. If you talk right off the top of your head, what do you think the best, not favorite, what's your best Tom Cruise movie? And I'll tell you one that people have forgotten. That's a great movie.
I mean, for me, I hate Tom Cruise.
So no, he's very polarizing.
Risky Business. I mean, I'm going to go all the way back to Risky Business because I didn't hate him at that stage.
Okay, I'll tell you a great Tom Cruise movie, and that Michael Mann was involved in, and that is Collateral, where Tom Cruise plays a hitman who has one night to kill. I think it's like three people in L.A., and Jamie Foxx is the cab driver that he hires, and it's an amazing piece of work, visually speaking. It's a good movie, but visually speaking, as they basically crawl through the nightscape of Los Angeles, it's an amazing visual piece of work, and he did a really good job. And like I said, you're absolutely right. Tom Cruise, very polarizing figure. Some people can't stand him. Some people, you know, really are big fans. I get that. So, okay, Barry, that about wraps it up. Before we go do the go home, my sister texted me this morning. Shout out to my sister, Reen Williams. She said, tell Barry that he mispronounced the name of the city where the fan fest is going to take place. She said, and I love this quote, she said, tell Barry that the name of the town, Lutz, and she puts rhymes with Apollonia's butt, not her glutes. So the name is Lutz, Florida. Tell us the date again, Barry.
I don't know about that one. I'm going to have to get somebody who lives there. I've always been told that it's Lutz, that it isn't Lutz. Now, it's spelled L-U-T-Z as Lutz.
And if she's wrong, we're calling her out on it next episode.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's is it Lutz or is it either way?
We'll put up a poll.
L-U-T-Z. We'll put up a poll. Is it Lutz or Lutz? It's spelled Lutz. I'll give her that. But I've always heard it pronounced Lutz, that it's Lutz, Florida. But it is it is June the 2nd in Lutz at the beautiful Residence Inn by Marriott on the Suncoast Parkway. June the 2nd, so far we've got Bob Roop returning to Florida. Bob Roop, 1969 to 1986. He spent time in Florida. Steve Kern, everybody associates Steve Kern with the state of Florida. And Buddy Colt, the living legend, Buddy Colt, will be making one of his last FanFest appearances, if not his last FanFest appearance. We have some more big names coming up. You can check us out on Facebook at Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives or the CWF Legends FanFest page. You can purchase tickets also directly through Eventbrite.
Okay, and we're really looking forward to that. Some great guests, and we want to encourage you to go to that site that Barry mentioned, and we'll have a good time. I will be the moderator. I look forward to meeting any of you newcomers, any of my friends who have not yet made it to one of the fan fest, and you know who you are. So, that being said, Breaking Kayfabe, it's a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special thanks to our friend, the great Brian Last. And until next week, this episode has been number 17. She's sexy and 17 like the Stray Cats. So next week will be 18. Should we go, Barry, with the Alice Cooper, I'm 18, or go Skid Row, 18 to Life? Which one you like better?
18 to Life, Skid Row.
There you go. See you next week, folks.